everybody. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate you supporting us, supporting those that support the podcast. Don't forget the Swing and Sound. Don't forget to head over to drdrew.com and click through on those various banners and things. And also, sign up for the contact list. Any questions you might have, we'll try to read them on the various shows. And don't forget the other shows that we've got there, the other pods at drdrew.com. Now, today I am extremely excited. Now, full disclosure, I'm geeking out a little bit. Dr. John Kelly is the founder and director of the Recovery Research Institute at Massachusetts General Hospital, also the associate director of the Center for Addiction Medicine at Mass General, associate professor of psychiatry in the field of addiction medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Kelly, and I believe it's called the Spallin Professor. Is that right, Dr. Kelly?
That's right, yes.
I am a tremendous fan of your work, and I appreciate you spending a little time with me. I'm deeply appreciative.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the sort of the state of addiction treatment and what a kind of mess it is, if you don't mind, and your perspectives on it. I want to sort of back into how people navigate through the system and then what we do to empower the most common source of mental health resources that happens to be free, mutual aid societies. Dr. Kelly.
Yeah. Well, if you zoom out for a couple of minutes and think about where we've come from, I've just been thinking about this lately just because it's roughly 50 years, coming up for 50 years since the war on drugs was declared under the Nixon administration back in the early 70s. And if you think about it from the big picture perspective, we've come a long way in terms of treatment provision, the development of treatments for substance use disorders and addiction, both pharmacological treatments as well as empirically supported, evidence-based psychosocial treatments. As a result of that concerted effort from the federal government way back then, 50 years ago, not only was that, obviously there was a lot of rhetoric around the punitive stance on the war on drugs, but also a lot of positive public health moves came out of that, including research institutes like National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, National Institute of Drug Abuse, SAMHSA, CSAT, ONDCP, all these things that came out from that have produced a lot of very good treatments. We've come a long way, first of all, in the last 50 years, particularly in the last 30 years, in both in terms of developing, testing new treatments and pharmacological treatments, as well as implementing those treatments around the country. So that's the good news. Now, things aren't perfect, of course. We've got a long way to go. There's always room for improvement in terms of implementing treatments, delivering them, creating a workforce which is qualified to deliver them, and making use of all our resources, as you alluded to, not just formal treatment, but also the provision and support of community-based supports that can sustain people in remission over the long term at little to no cost. And these are things like mutual aid organizations, mutual help organizations, as you alluded to, but also a growing cadre of different kinds of entities that are largely low-cost but have high X density in terms of their ubiquity in local communities that can sustain remission. So a lot of those things have come around really in the last 10 to 20 years, and we're developing a research base on them now.
That latter category, give us some examples of what you mean by those.
So some of those would be things like recovery community centers. So these are like senior centers, but for people in and seeking recovery. So we are just doing, for example, the first big study of these in New England and New York State. So these are places where people can go during the day. They can find support for recovery, instrumental support in terms of linking people to jobs, employers who will take people with criminal records, for example. They'll be taught how to put the CV together, a cover letter. They get support there for young moms in recovery. They can get access to recovery coaches or recovery mentors themselves in recovery. that can help them navigate the system, the treatment system, and recovery support service system. So that's one entity that's come around. There's recovery residences, of course, have been around a long time. There's now good empirical support and cost effectiveness of these recovery high schools, collegiate recovery programs, mutual aid organizations like AA, NA, LifeRing, Smart Recovery. All of these kind of community-based entities have grown in the last 30 years in particular.
Now, there's no doubt that these things work. It seems like one of the weaknesses we have now is getting people not just to them, but into them. And I know Keith Humphreys has a bunch of data at Stanford, about sort of the warm handoff and getting people to get to these programs. Because if you give them a pamphlet and some education, they don't go. But if you have somebody show up from the program and say, I'll meet you this evening at such and such an address, they tend to go, and they have a whole different experience too. Is that an area we need to improve things?
Definitely. And I think that's one of the rationales for this recovery coach movement around the country.
Yeah.
It's very much in vogue right now, isn't it?
I know that.
We hear a lot.
The governor, Christie, was big on that in New Jersey for a minute. I'm not sure what that was exactly, what those people were supposed to be, but the idea I got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, the recovery coaches are essentially peers in recovery. They're peer-based support entities, peer support specialists that have this catchy name, recovery coach. But essentially, that model emanated from the research on actually AA and NA mutual help groups. And what you're alluding to is the research that was done actually quite a long time ago now, but it's been replicated several times, which described and tested this idea of a warm handoff or personal connection with somebody who is already in recovery and is embedded in one of these recovery support services. And here's an example of a very well done and compelling study that was done that really demonstrates this principle of a warm handoff. It was done in 1981 by Sisson and Malams. They did a randomized study where they randomized people who'd never been to AA or 12-step groups before. They were leaving treatment, and they were randomized either to just a encouragement to attend, so it would be giving them a meeting list and saying, we'd strongly recommend that you go to AA and NA and groups like that because they're going to help you in your recovery, versus the other group that patients were randomized to was the same thing, but in addition to the meeting list and the recommendation to attend, they were asked to get on the phone with a current member who agreed to meet them to a meeting. They followed them up for 1 month to see how many people in each group got to their first meeting. And so a simple study, and basically what they found, and again, these were people who had never been before, okay? So they'd never been to AA or NA before. So in the standard referral group where they gave them a meeting list with clinical encouragement to attend, nobody attended their first meeting. Nobody
Zero.
Went at all.
Crazy.
Zero. Yeah. Zero. In the other group, every single person went. In fact, they went to roughly 2 to 3 meetings.
A VA group? So, is that if I remember right? Was it a VA thing? No. Okay.
No, it was replicated in the VA.
Oh.
Christine Timko at Stanford did 3 replications now of that style of intervention, which is essentially that idea of a warm handoff, a linkage to a person who is already embedded in that community resource. In those instances, it was 12-step groups. But the same principle that you're alluding to is, I think, has been replicated, demonstrated, that the advantage of having a peer who, as part of a clinical team or as part of a recovery community center team, that can help people get and stay linked into, via building rapport, breaking down those barriers of stigma and discrimination, which often people with addiction problems feel, when they're able to connect with somebody who's been there, trodden that path, has that lived experience of active addiction and recovery, they're more likely to get connected and become engaged in that free community resource.
Is it also accurate that mutual aid societies are the most commonly accessed or certainly searched category of mental health resource in this country?
Yes, by far.
And it's free. And it's free for the most part. I mean, most of them are free. What? First of all, I have two just sort of incredulity questions. How much can be saved, and why do we have any resistance to getting behind this?
Well, yeah. So we've actually just finished a systematic review on Alcoholics Anonymous and 12-step facilitation interventions. So these are clinically delivered interventions that stimulate linkage to AA in particular. Now, we've just finished this Cochrane review, so it's fresh on my mind, actually, because we just finished it and submitted it yesterday.
Oh, congratulations. That's a big deal.
It was a huge deal, yeah. It was a massive amount of work,
I'm very
glad to have it off my radar. But anyway, it was just a ton of work. But anyway, it was interesting. I think the results are may surprise some people, at least, that just how good these free resources are. Number one, increasing rates of continuous abstinence and remission. And number two, at increasing the average number of days on which people are abstinent, and also decreasing consequences related to alcohol and other drug use. But also, as you alluded to, because these are free resources, they also confer a very large economic benefit. So I describe this as really the closest thing in public health that we have to a free lunch. Now, here's why. In a study that was done in the VA system, which obviously is the largest healthcare system in the world, and they are incentivized because it is a national healthcare system, they have a natural incentive to maximize quality and reduce costs. And so one of the studies, big studies that they did, was to actually do a comparative evaluation of programs, treatment programs, that strongly encouraged linkage to AA and NA versus did not. So they compared those two different types of programs. When they looked at their clinical outcomes at 1 and 2 years after treatment, they found that, in general, patients coming from these two types of programs, one that strongly encouraged AA and NA participation and one not, they found that the patients coming from the programs where they were strongly linked to AA and NA had significantly better abstinence outcomes. Otherwise, the outcomes were similar across programs. So they had higher rates of continuous abstinence by about one-third.
Wow.
But here's the thing. What they also found was that, on average, it saved about $10,000 per patient over this two-year period.
Jesus.
In terms of reductions in healthcare resources, because people were utilizing these free, ubiquitous Indigenous community recovery support services, namely Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. So essentially, if you think about that $10,000 per patient and improving outcomes, if you multiply that by the roughly 1 million or so just with an alcohol use disorder who get treated every year, that's $10 billion in savings.
And that doesn't take into account the lost workforce, you know, the returning to the workforce,
no,
or any of those sorts
that's
of things. Yeah.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Right now. So that's not accounting the increase in productivity and reduction to criminal justice costs. So that's purely healthcare savings. That's $10 billion. That's only if you count 1 million people with alcohol use disorder who treat. Now, we know roughly 2.3 million people get treated formally for a substance use disorder each year. And then most of those, you know, 60-70% are alcohol use disorder. So that's an underestimate. But just a minimum of $10 billion in savings through linking to these free, Indigenous, ubiquitous recovery resources, namely Alcoholics Anonymous in this case, can actually reduce that economic, you know, burden for these disorders confer, and simultaneously improve outcomes. So that's why I call it the best, you know, kind of the closest thing we have to the free lunch in public health.
Absolutely,
because we've got, you know, so many of these free recovery support resources, not just AA and NA, but things like Smart Recovery, Life Ring, Women for Sobriety, all these other different entities which have emerged and grown over the years, which I would argue may also confer similar benefits.
So this is my incredulity. Why isn't that headline news, and why in the world do we resist this? For those of us in the field, it's imminently obvious, and yet to see people even push back to the slightest degree to this is categorically mystifying to me.
Well, I think part of it has been kind of the representation of the research and the misrepresentation of the evidence base for it. And this is part of the reason why we wanted to do this new Cochrane review, because the Cochrane review system, as you know, is the gold standard in medical science, yep, and it's recognized as such around the world.
When can I get it? When can I get my hands on it?
Well, it will be out probably in the next couple of months. It's just under review right now, so it'll be out in a couple of months, and I'll be happy to send it to you. I mean, you'll hear about it because I suspect it will get a lot of publicity, yes, and it will be news. Now, and I think part of it, in answer to your question, is that it's just the kind of the lack of systematic, production of a good summary of the evidence. And so there's lots of piecemeal pieces that people have gathered together and put out. But this is a very concrete, systematic, highly rigorous, transparent review.
If there's any resistance,
we'll put the records straight.
If there's real resistance in the months after this comes out, you and I have to have another conversation to figure out what the problem is, because it should be a sea change. It should be a categorical change in the discussion about mutual aid societies, and it should be put to rest.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Well, our friends at Purple Mattress, that's right, it's a 100-night risk-free trial. You've got to check it out. It's the founders of this are two brothers who have been developing cushioning technology for 30 years, things like medical beds and wheelchairs. And in 2016, they finally decided to use their patented comfort technology to create Purple. I love this mattress. We've got it at our house. It's different. Purple Mattress will probably be different than anything you've ever experienced because it uses this brand-new material that was developed by an actual rocket scientist. It's not like the memory foam you're used to. Purple material feels very unique. It's both firm and soft at the same time, so it supports while feeling really comfortable. It's supported where you need it. It's breathable and it's cool. I mean, it's literally cool because it's breathable, and so you stay cool at night. And again, there's a 100-night risk-free trial. If you're not fully satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund with free shipping and returns, backed by a 10-year warranty. I mean, they really stand behind their product here because they know what they've got. They've got something good, something special, and you will like it. Free in-home setup, old mattress removal. Now, you're going to love Purple. And right now, my listener will get a free sheets and a free mattress protector with your mattress purchase. Just go to Purple, that's the color, purple.com/DREW. That is purple.com/Drew, purple.com/Drew. All right, help our podcast stay free to download with minimal ads. Responses will help us align at this Podcast One survey. Survey short, it's anonymous, takes no more than 5 minutes. Go to podcastone.com/mysurvey or go to podcastone and click on the survey banner. If you filled it out in the past, we do thank you, but we still need to do it again if you can. Do all of us at Corolla Network and Podcast One a huge favor by filling it out. Thank you for supporting my program and taking the time to complete the survey. Really do appreciate it. It helps us align the appropriate advertisers to this audience and stay free to download. Here are some useful car tips you might not be aware of. Coffee filter and a bit of olive oil clean your interior. Get the excess weight out of your car. Improve your gas mileage. Why don't we think about that? Keep the proper tire pressure in your tires. Well, here's another tip you might not know, but I don't know where you've been if you don't. TrueCar helps people get used cars as well as new cars. It's not just for buying new cars. With their TrueCar certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you will enjoy the TrueCar way, which is real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you're buying new or used. And with TrueCar users, you see what others paid, you see that scattergram, so you know you're getting a good deal. The price you lock in is for an actual vehicle on a TrueCar certified dealer's lot. They're also going to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with the TrueCar certified dealers. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar for a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Now, there you have a slide that's sort of famous in my own mind that I wonder if it has something to do with some of this resistance, but maybe you could review it for me a little bit here. There's the duration to that first year of sustained sobriety, the number of treatments, the duration, how much time it takes, the years it takes in the contemplative phase. I don't think the public understands that. So when they don't see a magical cure, they're sort of confused by things. But go ahead and review that.
No, I know what slide you're referring to. Yeah, it's something that you know, I put together many years ago, just because I think when we can get, you know, disheartened perhaps as clinicians or as family members when we don't see our loved one or patient getting well as quickly as we might want. But when we zoom out and we look at the bigger picture of what actually happens clinically in the clinical course of an alcohol or other drug use disorder, we can see a fairly long-term view. And I think this is where the idea of a chronic illness comes from. Basically, when we look at studies of people who have substance use disorder and look at their clinical course, what we see is that it takes about 4 to 5 years after the onset of their disorder before they will start seeking specialty treatment. So that could be some kind of outpatient treatment, speaking to a provider, attending a mutual health group, or some kind of formal or informal intervention. It takes about 4 to 5 years after the onset of the disorder. Now, part of that delay, of course, is the stigma and discrimination and fear that people, shame that people feel when they have this disorder, because they see other people being able to control their alcohol or other drug use, but they cannot. And there's a lot of potential negative consequences which could come about as a result of acknowledgement and disclosure. So try and keep it hidden. When after that 4 to 5 year period, they find that they are unable to go on any longer, or there's some kind of intervention by the criminal justice system, like a DUI or something that brings them into contact with the treatment system, it still takes about 4 to 5 treatments and about 8 years on average to achieve 1 year of full sustained remission. So that's quite a lot. Again, that's an average. So some people are actually getting into recovery right away, but on average, about 8 years to achieve 1 year of full sustained remission, and on average about 4 to 5 treatments. The thing to remember there is that although that might seem a little bit disappointing and say, well, isn't that, you know, can't we do better? Again, this is an average, but most of those days actually are abstinent days. So when people are even get their first treatment, they might stay sober, let's say abstinent for a few months and have a relapse. They might get sober on the next attempt. They might get stay sober for 6 months, have a relapse, 9 months. But until they get that 1 year of full sustained remission, that is pretty much complete abstinence or no symptoms for 1 year, it takes about 8 years on average. Now, here's the other thing, and this is where I think we need to pay attention to the management, the recovery management or disease management of addiction, is that even after people achieve 1 year of full sustained remission, it takes on average about 4 to 5 years of sustained remission before the risk of meeting criteria for substance use disorder in the next year falls below 15%. So why 15%? Because 15% is the annual risk in the general population of meeting criteria for a substance use disorder. So to be no more likely than anybody else in the general population to meet criteria for a substance use disorder in the next year, if you've already had it, takes 4 to 5 years of continuous remission. So this is why groups like AA, NA, mutual aid groups, recovery support services in general, recovery community centers, et cetera, can play a very strong role in our overall public health approach to these endemic problems, because they can provide this ongoing community-based support that can help people stay in remission over the long term. What we generally see, of course, in studies, most studies of treatment, are only 12 weeks of treatment with, if we're lucky, a one-year follow-up. So we don't capture this longer-term view of what is needed to address these chronic illnesses over time. And this is where I think it's very important for us to recognize, and I think that's why there's been this growth in these long-term recovery support services, which are highly cost-effective.
Yeah. So I want to I'm going to say it a little harshly, which is that the way addiction research is done is inadequate because the timelines are too short. And by the way, the data they look at is often inadequate too. And then also so many are lost to follow-up, and they often don't count those as treatment failures. So I'm just always looking at jaundicely at addiction treatment, you know, evidence-based research, because it's often really weak data. It's very, very weak. And the timelines are inadequate. But that's sort of my harsh sort of vision of so much of the research that's led us down the primrose path in so many directions. The other thing is that, you know, the manpower and the resources that a mutual aid society provides, they will sit on people with addiction and watch them and stay on top of them. There simply aren't enough healthcare dollars on earth to meet that need of people early in recovery that the mutual aid societies can provide. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to look much more broadly at, you know, because this is the top public health problem in the country, it's actually the top public health problem in most middle and high income countries around the world, and it confers a huge burden of disease, disability, premature mortality, that really, you know, our professional treatment system can do a lot, but it can't do it cannot do everything, and this is why we need all the help that we can get. And so, you know, when we have free entities in the community that have been shown to be effective and cost effective, we need to pay attention to that in terms of our national policy.
That's right.
Because, you know, these are expensive things to treat. These are high volume, high burden diseases that we can't afford to have everybody go and see a physician every week for.
Right.
You know, we need to find, you know, they can play a very powerful role. Don't get me wrong. Clinicians and professionals play a very powerful role. They can be a turning point for many people.
And some essential. Some people need medical management, psychiatry. I'm not demeaning the need for that. But I am just astonished the way we squander the resource or attacked the resource of mutual aid societies over the last 20 years. It's been just bewildering to me. But I recently spoke with Dr. Robert DuPont, who was the really great guy, and he experiences recovery and addiction much the way you and I do and understands it the same way. And I was surprised to hear his enthusiasm still for replacement kinds of therapy. And the way he talked about it, and I want to get your opinion about this, he talked about public versus, well, he didn't use the word private, but he was talking about public resources for addiction treatment. And I think what he was saying was, and he used the word scalability a number of times, and of course we're talking about the opiate crisis here particularly when we talk about that. And I think he had sort of was saying, well, in order to save lives and people with no resources and, you know, multiple diagnoses, the only way we're going to do it is with some kind of replacement management. Do you agree with that?
Replacement management being like methadone or Suboxone?
Correct.
Yes.
And just let me tell you my own bias on it. I'm worried about the excessive enthusiasm about it. I see tons of my peers prescribing for these patients and really have no understanding of the patients or how to treat addiction or what recovery is or what addicts are all about. And yet they're, you know, handling a couple hundred of them. And I know exactly what I'm doing. I don't think I can handle 30. And so it's just concerning to me the excessive enthusiasm for that and at the same time attacking mutual aid societies. But I just want you particularly to address what I suggested about Dr. DuPont's point of view, which is that to be scalable and to be effective and to save lives, this may be our only alternative. What do you say?
Yeah, well, I think we have to look to the evidence base. And this is what I think is very important. As much as possible when trying to come up with good policy, rational policy, healthcare policy, it's very important to look to the evidence. Now, we have good evidence for methadone. We have good evidence for Suboxone, for buprenorphine, in terms of its ability to reduce infectious disease transmission, to reduce overdose death. And these are things, I think, are the most important things, is to make sure that we keep people alive, number one. Number two, can we stabilize them so that they have a chance to get into long-term recovery? And both of those medications have been shown to do that, and they're really first-line treatments. So when we're talking about opioid use disorder, we're really talking about the effectiveness of these medications to as first-line treatments. Now, naltrexone also, which is an antagonist, not an agonist, of course, but the has also been shown to be efficacious also, particularly when people are already stabilized off of opioids. So if you can actually, and they just did a big trial, which was published in JAMA, I think it was just about a month or two ago, which found that it was a head-to-head trial of buprenorphine, naloxone, and naltrexone, And overall, the buprenorphine, the Suboxone, did better overall. But here was an important nuance to their finding, was that if people were actually detoxed and stabilized off of opioids, they did better on naltrexone. So both of these, all three of those medications, both methadone, full agonist, partial agonist buprenorphine, and an antagonist naltrexone, or the injectable Vivitrol once a month shot, was shown to be very helpful for people with opioid use disorder. So these, of course, are scalable in the sense that they can be quickly implemented, disseminated, and implemented as long as docs are trained to, as you say, you know, to know what to do and use the proper protocol to deliver the treatment.
And again, isn't it interesting that we only use naltrexone on our peers, on physicians and mental health professionals? We don't use buprenorphine on our peers. But okay, just I mean, not at least not while, let them go back to work. Right?
Yeah, no, it's interesting how you get these different, different protocols for different subpopulations.
Right.
I'm not quite sure, don't really understand that.
Right. Yeah, and I don't understand, the only, and when I look at the literature, there's two things that concern me. There's not an enthusiasm for naltrexone, which I don't understand why there isn't an enthusiasm for it. The enthusiasm for buprenorphine is largely built on the fact that the patients find it rewarding and that they behave better as patients, which I'm not sure is a good sign for their recovery. So I don't know. I just worry about that. And I'm really worried about the concurrent use of other substances, which a lot of guys, a lot of physicians aren't screening for. And the younger patients that I have that on Suboxone divert it to their peers to buy heroin. And the older patients on Suboxone use other drugs. That's sort of been my experience. And a lot of that doesn't get picked up by the literature.
Mm. Yeah, no, undoubtedly some of that goes on. We see that where I work also. But I think, again, when we look at the studies that have been done, some of these are quite long-term studies. There was one study, for example, called the POTE study, which was on opioid agonist treatments for prescription opioid use disorder. And it was a large multi-site trial. They followed them up for 42 months after initiating buprenorphine, naloxone. And they found roughly two-thirds were in remission at 42 months. So that's good news when you're talking about an illness which can potentially kill a lot of people, that can actually produce that degree of remission. So, you know, these medications have shown, in randomized controlled trials with pretty good follow-up over time to be, effective and can help people reduce overdose deaths and also help people to get and stay in remission. But I think we have to be careful. Your point was well taken that, we don't want to fall into the trap of one size fits all.
Right.
And I think that's where, in some ways, we are going with buprenorphine. It certainly is a first-line treatment. It's very important because it can save lives. But any patient want to take it, so they won't take it. What do you do then? You can't just say, well, see you later then, come back when you're ready.
Right.
We need to have something else that we can offer people who are unwilling to take that first-line treatment, even though it's effective. So what do? And I think we've lacked the attention to alternative pathways which need to be properly investigated. One of those, I think, is sober living environments.
Yeah.
So, for example, having people go with strong, who don't want to go on medication, who won't go on medication, what do you do? So we have good evidence for sober living environments that people can get into those and find a pathway to recovery that way.
I had ways of getting people into sober living with food for $800 a month, and it was between that and an naltrexone injection for $600. I would send them to the sober living. That was a conundrum I was faced with a lot, and so the again, how we allocate the dollar resources is very challenging.
Yeah, and I think we really do need right now. We need more research on other pathways when patients are not going to take medications. What are we going to do instead? And we can't just turn patients away. We've got to find other alternatives which can be you know, ideally, as at least as effective as medications can be for opioid use disorder.
Now, you may have seen me talking about a product called TheraWorks Relief. And if you are one of the millions of Americans who suffer from muscle cramps in your legs and feet, this is relief. And now we're starting to get testimonials coming in, and I'm really proud of this product. It's a way of getting relief from muscle cramps, which is something that can really make people suffer and disrupt your sleep. And sometimes older patients can really be a burden, and it's doing it without taking a pill. TheraWorks Relief is a tropical foam that's clinically proven to relieve muscle cramps fast, and with daily use, TheraWorks Relief can even prevent muscle cramps before they start. Now, for over a year, I've been recommending TheraWorks Relief to my family and friends and some patients as well. And my patients have been passing it on to other people. I didn't ask them to do that, but they've been doing it. Now, the word breakthrough gets tossed around easily these days, but TheraWorks Relief is the real deal. It's a life-changing product, and best of all, you don't need a prescription. TheraWorks Relief is my choice for preventing and relieving muscle cramps. Make it yours, too. Get TheraWorks Relief today at select CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens pharmacies, or at TheraWorksRelief.com. That's TheraWorksRelief, TheraWorksRelief.com. And talk to your pharmacist about TheraWorks Relief. They're as happy as I am because you don't have to take a pill. Experience relief for muscle cramps for yourself. That is TheraWorks Relief for your muscle cramps. All right, you heard me talk about Quip. This is not the first time, right? It's something you use every day. It makes a boring part of your day enjoyable, and you don't have to go to the store to get it because Quip ships directly to your door. It's that perfect $25 product, and it is the right thing, and it is supported by professionals. Quip starts at just $25, and right now when you go to GetQuip, G-E-T-Q-U-I-P, getquip.com/Drew, get your first refill pack with a Quip electronic toothbrush. You get the free refill pack for free. That is your first refill pack for free at getquip.com/Drew. Again, Quip comes with a mount. You know it. It's a new electric toothbrush that packs the right amount of vibrations into an ultra-slim design. Guiding pulses to simplify better brushing. This is the future. Adam always talks about there being no advances in dentistry. Well, this is an advance. It also offers that optional subscription plan, delivering new brush heads on a dentist-recommended 3-month schedule for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. That's it. Get Quip Toothbrush. Again, it's getquip.com/Drew. I want to go back to that 42-month multi-center study you mentioned. Where was that published? Do you remember? Because I think I remember seeing that study, and I think I remember sort of dismissing it because there was a huge dropout rate, if I remember right. Like, huge. If I remember.
No. Not in that study. That was a good, that had a good high follow-up rate. Roger Weiss from McLean was the PI, okay. And I forget now where. It may have been American Journal of Psychiatry or... I can't remember yet. I can definitely send you the article.
I'll find it. I don't read Journal Psychiatry, so that's probably why I didn't see that one. It's reminding me of one I saw in the addiction medicine journals. And as usual, I look at the dropout rate and I'm like, forget it. But good. That's good to hear. That's good to know. What keeps you up at night now? What are you worried about? Obviously the Cochrane study, but now that you're over that, what's gonna, and I think I'm hearing you saying other alternatives to the medication resistant patient. But is there things you're worrying about?
Well, you know, I mean, it's. I think we have to be smarter overall in our approaches. You know, in terms of how we go about addressing these endemic problems. You know, we've got this opioid overdose epidemic, which is so heartbreaking and infuriating at the same time to watch so many people, so many families bereaved by this very preventative disorder and preventative accident of overdose. So that's really sickening and disheartening, and we need to be very urgent about what we're doing, and we've lacked the urgency in addressing it. We've started to mobilize, but it's still we're still way behind the curve.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of good things, and I think we have to really pay attention to the same kinds of strategies that we're implementing now in crisis to make sure that we improve our public health infrastructure for addressing these behavioral health problems, both addiction and mental health, right across the board going forward, so we don't fall into this same trap. You know, we're talking about spending trillions of dollars on infrastructure, but what about public health infrastructure? That's where, we've got people dying right now from accidents and injuries and overdoses related to alcohol and other drug use in the hundreds of thousands, much more than any you know traffic infrastructure accidents and injuries and car crashes, and yet we don't spend we only spend a fraction of the amount of money that we're proposing to spend on other infrastructure. So I think being smarter about public health and recognizing these endemic problems that need to be addressed in a much more cost-efficient way. And that's why I think we need both formal and informal to be smart about. And to be fair, we are, working with the government right now. I'm doing a few things with the government to actually deliver to them a systematic review, so like this Cochrane review and other reviews that we've done, to establish the, what we know from a science base about these entities that can address these endemic problems, both treatment and non-treatment, formal and informal interventions. So I'll be going down to D.C. later in the summer to present those data, those systematic reviews across these different entities, so that we can actually, be smarter about how we focus our attention, not just on professional services, but also on these other entities to address these problems.
I so hope you get some progress that way, even if it's just they want to spend, they want to hold drug companies and accountable, for some of this epidemic. And I imagine there's going to be a large sum, much like in the tobacco settlement. And I'm hoping some of it goes to, supporting and educating about mutual aid societies. It would be a tragedy if it didn't, it seems to me.
Well, I think we need to recognize that we've got these free, ubiquitous indigenous communities recovery support services all over the place. We just saw a study actually, thankfully, from the National Institutes of Health, just got funded last week. It's a 5-year study looking at SMART Recovery, which is a cognitive behavioral recovery support group. It's kind of like a secular version of AA,
yeah,
based on cognitive behavioral principles. So it's the first, it's going to be the first real world investigation of this growing mutual aid group,
right,
like AA, but different, but has the same kind of therapeutic dynamics operating in peer support as an alternative. So because we know that not everybody goes to 12-step groups or wants to go, but if we have other entities that we can say, these other entities also work, if we can produce more studies, and that's why I'm grateful that we got funded to do this study to look at SMART Recovery. So we can then say, look, there's another option, and it's empirically supported. Hopefully we'll find empirical support for it. If not, it can be something else. But we can offer that to patients who are in or seeking recovery as another pathway to them. And we need much more research like that.
Yeah.
Thankfully, NIAAA, actually, to give them a call out, a shout out here, National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, have actually made recovery research a priority last year. So that, they put out a program announcement for more recovery research. And it's exactly the kind of things that I've been talking about. So looking at recovery community centers, mutual aid groups, including AA, as well as Smart Recovery, LifeRing, other entities that are out there in the communities in which people live, right around the corner from where they live. So if we can find empirical support for these things at sustaining remission, the way that we have for AA, then that's really good news, because as a nation, as a society, we need to find cost-effective, smart ways that we can utilize all of our resources to bring to bear on these endemic behavioral health problems.
Recovery has not been Dr. Koob's interest. Is he the one leading the way in that?
He's been actually, despite the fact that he comes from from the other end of the spectrum in terms of science. He was looking at compounds, developing compounds and molecules to understand the neurobiology of addiction.
That's his thing. And made some major breakthroughs too. Very, very important stuff.
Yeah.
But he's
Exactly. But he's interested in the big macro picture. How do we get and keep people in remission? How do we achieve that? That's what he's really about. Now, we can do that across right across the spectrum, from the molecular level to the, you know, public health level, to the epidemiological level. So, and he's all about how do we do that. So he, I think he's been a really great addition as the leader of NIAAA to bring the focus around to sustaining remission and recovery.
That's great. That is good news, because I've always liked his work, but I didn't know he was interested in this stuff too. So very interesting. Well, I really do appreciate you spending a little time with me here today. I mean, I hope people get something out of this. I'm extremely interested that this Cochrane study get out there, and that people sort of, you know, 12-step and mutual aid has been under attack for a while, and it's hurting people and it's wasting money, and it should be an integrated part of what everyone does who's struggling with these conditions. It's free, it's available, it's effective. I mean, why wouldn't you? If you really want to get well, why wouldn't you use the modalities that are available? And particularly ones that are free. It's always been sort of mysterious and astonishing to me that people would not. And, you know, when I don't know about your experience, Dr. Kelly, but when I, you know, people get sober long term with my patients, they always look back at whatever I did and went, yeah, you really didn't do anything. You just kind of turned me towards this process. And I'm like, I'm fine. I'm good. I'm fine. As long as I got you into the process, I'll take that. I didn't need to do anything more. Your outcome is all that matters.
That's pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
Many patients tell me that they got into recovery just in spite of me.
I've had that too. Don't worry. Had that too. I consider that a therapeutic intervention if I piss them off enough to get sober. That's always good.
No, but I think you're right. I think, you know, I think that we've done a poor job scientifically of presenting the evidence. I think this Cochrane review is going to help a lot, because I think it's going to really show the evidence in its truest form, its most transparent form. And I think, and I hope that will get disseminated, and people, because it's really, you know, I'm chiefly a science-based person. So if I can look to see what's the evidence, what's the good quality systematic evidence, and what does it point to, what should we be doing, that's what we need to look to. And I think this, you know, Cochrane review has shown that. These other studies that I've mentioned on medications or other recovery support services have also shown that. So we just need to look to the science base and have that be ideally the way that we form policy.
Of course, but I have to beg your forgiveness and patience when it you know, because the reason you had to do this big review is because the science was unsound before and it didn't fit with the clinical experience we were all having, and yet there was stuff being shoved at us. And people were being demeaned for doing things that had worked for 30 years for free.
Right.
That made a kind of a skepticism about the way the science was being done. Of course, the science eventually will prevail. It will tell the story. But for a while there, it wasn't telling it accurately. And I'm so thankful that finally it will.
Yes, I agree.
Listen, at the moment you need help shouting about this, or it's available, or it can be shouted about, please send it my way, because I will be very vocal about this, because it's very exciting.
I'll be very happy to. Yeah, thank you.
Will it be posted on your website?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. No, it'll be all over the place. I think once it's published, you know, it's going to be all over the media. I'm sure you will hear about it.
All right.
I can certainly send it to you as soon as we know that it will be, you know, when it will be officially published,
right.
and we'll let you know.
And I will ask the listeners to look forward at John Kelly, KELLYPHD.com. You can find it there. And listen, I really appreciate you spending time with me today. I'll let you go. And I'm such a fan. I'm standing applauding and I'm a cheerleader. And so whatever I can do to help support, please, please do not hesitate. Thank you for spending time with us.
Bob. You bet. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Good talking to you. Thank you.
You bet. John Kelly. And hope you all learned something. I'll see you next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah. Of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.